Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. Such wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envying and strife are, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. From the general epistle of St. James in the third chapter. The child Jesus grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And when they had fulfilled the days as they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother knew not of it. And they, supposing him to have been in the company, went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. And when they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him. And it came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And he said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my father's business? And they understood not the saying which he spake unto them. But his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. From the second chapter of the Gospel according to St. Luke. Well, good morning, friends. And so today is the eighth Sunday after Trinity, and as you know, we have an intent of wisdom, and of course wisdom is very important to us because we're a church that believes we're part of the wisdom tradition. So, of course, we're going to talk about wisdom today. But I do want to point out that in most other churches, today they will be celebrating the Transfiguration, and that's because, apparently, of the energies of this time of the year as we move into the Lion's Gate on the 8th of August. So traditionally, the Transfiguration is celebrated on the Sunday after, I think, the 6th of August. So just after the Lion's Gate, or just before the Lion's Gate. In this case, just before the Lion's Gate. So you'd think that with my white hair and white beard now, by now, I'd have a bit of wisdom. But apparently not, because it's been a real struggle coming up with what I was going to say in this talk. William James says that wisdom is about knowing what to overlook, but apparently every time I went to write for today, I would write and write and write and come up with every single extraneous thing that I could possibly point a stick at and just keep on taking myself off track, and clearly I didn't know what to overlook. I clearly had no wisdom at all when I was writing, and so I thought that perhaps I should, the best thing for me to do to make sure that I do end up speaking from the heart is to extemporize. And today we've heard in the Gospel of Luke about Jesus, the 12-year-old boy, going up to Jerusalem and tarrying and arguing with the doctors of the law and, you know, having conversations with them and so on. And To be honest with you, this reminds me of another 12-year-old boy from Torah, the 12-year-old boy king, Solomon, who is faced with his first challenge of the wisdom he prayed for when, at 12 years old, two women come up and they have a baby between them, and the first woman says, this woman who we live in the same house, and but there's nobody else connected to us. We're two women living alone in this house, and we had two babies. We had a baby each, and last night she took my baby that was alive and replaced it with her baby that had died during the night. And when I woke up in the morning, I realized the baby was dead, and I brought it out into the light and realized it wasn't my baby. She's got my baby. And the second woman, when Solomon turns, says, what do you have to say about this? The second woman says, no, the baby that I have is mine and has always been mine. Should be mine. And Solomon looks at them and says, right, well, I have a solution for you. Since you can't decide whose baby it is, we'll cut the baby in half and you can have half each. Bring me a sword. And the second woman says, well, hold on. She can have the baby, Lord. And the first woman, the woman who came in with the complaint, says, well, neither of us shall have the baby. Cut! And Solomon says, well, the one who has held the baby all along, it's her baby. And so the woman who is willing to give up the baby is given the baby. And of course, the way that this is usually interpreted is you can see the milk of loving kindness in the woman who is willing to give up the child to make sure that the child lives. And clearly the person who was prepared to cut the baby in half, that nobody had a baby, she couldn't possibly be the baby's mother. And that's true enough. But why would this woman say this? Why would the first woman, the woman who came in with the claim who wanted to have the baby in the first place, why would she behave in this really odd manner and really show herself to be who she ought not to show herself to be? And behave in this very anti-life, anti-human sort of way. And of course, the rabbis say, well, Solomon knew the law. And there's a law in Devarim, that's Deuteronomy 25, called the Yibum laws. And it involves the loss of a husband. When a woman loses her husband without having children, she must enter a union with her brother-in-law, which binds her to her brother-in-law in marriage. And even if the brother-in-law is not of age, she must still be bound to the brother-in-law until he is of age, at which point he has the choice of whether he marries her or he releases her from the binding. And as you can probably tell from the description of the women the first woman's testimony about their situation. They live in a house together. They must be connected in some way, but they're clearly not mother and daughter or sisters, because they're behaving in a very unkinfolk sort of a way. But they must be still somehow connected to each other. And there's nobody else in the house with them, so it's not like they're servants or anything. They're obviously the women of the house. So this leads the rabbis to say, well, there must be daughter-in-law and mother-in-law. And so because Solomon understands these Yibum laws, he's able to set up a special test that enables him to be able to tell the difference between two women. And Jesus is actually shown to be just as wise in Torah as what Solomon is. Jesus in Matthew 22, 22nd chapter of Matthew, from verses 23 to 33, he's challenged by Zadokites about the resurrection and a woman who has a husband with six brothers. So there's seven brothers together. So what happens if one of the brothers dies and then she has to marry the brother-in-law? Moses says so. And what if he dies and she has to marry each one of the brothers until she gets to the end of the brothers, until they're all dead, and then she dies and then there's a resurrection? Who's going to be her husband? Because she can only have one husband. So who's going to be her husband? It's exactly the same laws as you have in, it's the same same laws, the same Devarim Yibum laws as you have in Solomon. And of course, Jesus' response to this is to say, you don't know your Torah because you don't know your scriptures because clearly they're not going to be there's not going to be any marriage and there's not going to be any none of this stuff is going to apply because these people will be with God and as if they were angels. Now the Midrash about the stuff in about Solomon's situation, where there's a Solomon seems to have known that the mother-in-law and daughter-in-law would be constrained by these laws, being as wise as he was in Torah, and he could by setting up a special trick incentivize one of the women to behave in an anti-life way. And so he uses his understanding of the law to create the conditions for exposing who the liar is. So his great wisdom is this understanding of the law, and he uses it to navigate towards truth skillfully. But is this what really happened, or is his wisdom something else? So I'll just explain very briefly how the trick actually works. The mother-in-law doesn't need the baby in order to be free of these constraints, but the daughter-in-law does need the baby. So the mother-in-law would rather have the baby survive because she's the mother of the baby, but also that baby would be her issue, whether he's her son or her grandson, he would still be her issue. And so so the baby is, so she's not going to be forced to marry any sort of brother or be bound to any brother-in-law. However, her daughter-in-law, if the baby turns out to be the mother-in-law's, will then be bound to the baby because the baby will be her own brother-in-law. Given that she's lost her husband, her husband's little brother would be the little baby. And so that puts her in a rather invidious position of being stuck with a baby for the next 30, or stuck with the child for the next 13 years, bound to it, unable to marry, unable to have more children, and thus missing out on her opportunity to have children, possibly. Or certainly the best opportunity for her to have children and marry. So it's in her best interest to have the child, but if she's also going to be able to say that she's not, if she's going to be truthful when it comes to the point where she's able to say that she's not bound to anybody, that there's no brother-in-law for her to be bound to, then it's better for her indeed if there is no baby at all. That's better for her. So by understanding these things, Solomon's able to navigate towards the truth. Just like Jesus uses the Torah to explain that the resurrection will be with God and like the angels, and so these Yibum laws will not apply. And he goes on to say something else about God being the God of the living, not the dead. Something to do with God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, God of the living. And this kind of tells us, this is a criticism of the law. It's another indication that the law is the law of death, just as it is really in the story about Solomon. Because the situation is that the law leads to this, these laws push people into positions where they do pernicious and things that actually go against their better judgment and their conscience. And there's also something here that indicates that the resurrection are the living, which means the people under the law are the dead. But the Pharisees, seeing how the Zadokites have just been rendered mute, they send in their best lawyer to ask Jesus what the... In the... I know it's usually that they say it's a scribe, usually, but the actual translation from Greek is a lawyer. He's a Pharisaical lawyer. To ask Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? And this is where the answers immediately, he answers straight away, quoting Devarim and Torah Kohanim, that's Deuteronomy and Leviticus. He immediately says the two love commandments. You know, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, strength, and soul. And the next commandment, which is like unto it, which is love thy neighbor as thyself, which is from Leviticus. And he says the whole law is derived from it, and the lawyer has to agree with him. But if the whole law is derived from love, and these love commandments, then that is also the boundary of the law. And then Jesus goes on to tie them in a few more knots to do with the Davidic Messiah and shows that the Messiah can't be the son of David. But knowledge of the law, they say, is wisdom. The rabbis and you know, generally we all agree that the wise are those who have mastery of the law, L-O-R-E, you know, our writings, our stories, our great, you know, our great stories, from which our law, L-A-W, is derived. So those who, you know, have mastered the Vedas became the people who, this is in the Hindu system, they became sannyasin and they step outside the world of caste and kin, seek a world of freedom beyond birth and death. The Buddha was a sannyasin, and they become the law givers, you know, the people that can break the molds, and because they know the law, they know the Vedas in this case. Those who master the Avesta become magi, concerned now with the celestial worlds, and they again step outside of the world of normal law. And those who mastered the tree law, which is a massive tapestry of epic poetry, became the Fili, those who see, called by the Romanized world druids, oak seers or oak knowers. Vid from druvid is similar to Veda, knowledge. And they become the lawmakers again. And those who master scripture become apostles and later bishops, again, lawmakers. But is all that really wisdom? I mean, I know that we consider all these people to be, you know, the Buddha and so on, the sannyasin, the Fili, the druids, the apostles. We consider them to be wise, do we not? But is all that really wisdom, all of that knowledge? If love bounds the law, and the law is derived from love, the love commandments, then doesn't that mean that being one with the love commandments is wisdom? But don't listen to me. I mean, if you go into your heart and you begin to reach out to people through your heart, do you think you would have more understanding of them than if you don't? Not your head understanding, the voice in your head, the concepts and all the technical information about this or that, or the fantastically complex descriptions of systems that all fit together beautifully. Not that kind of knowledge, that mechanical knowledge, which is dead letter knowledge and legalistic knowledge. It's head knowledge that wants to put everything into clever terminology and perfectly line up every concept. Does heart knowing do that? If you reach out with your heart and not your head, do you have less skillful means at your disposal when interacting with people, or more? If your head is empty so that your attention can sink down and enter the gate of the heart, are you less in tune with truth and therefore less able to navigate difficulties than if you are referring to a great body of technical law? Or are you more in tune with the truth of things and more able to navigate? If being a living expression of the love commandments is wisdom, and you know in our church we even call it love wisdom, don't we? Harikesa, the second rain. If wisdom is knowing what to overlook, and the virtues of wisdom are the virtues of agape, since James's epistle on Sophia mirrors Paul's 1 Corinthians 13 description of agape. And if the whole point of Christianity is kenosis or self-emptying, then doesn't that mean that the love which is wisdom is really emptiness? And if you empty your head of stuff so that it loses its grasping, its cleverness, so that it releases and releases and releases, and you sink into your heart right now, and allow your heart to also empty, because our hearts are often very full to the point where we have no room, full of stuff. Then when you empty your heart and let go of all that dust, when you let go of all that you're holding on to, then what is left is space. Lots of space. And the intelligence of that space is you. You are the space. That space is love. And then you truly begin to know what it is to love the one, the Lord thy God, with all thy mind and all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy strength. Because your intellect can now find the proper place in serving the wisdom of the empty heart. And loving your neighbor as yourself comes naturally, because there's plenty of space for everyone in a heart that has expanded because it's empty. And it's very simple, but hard to maintain. So you have to practice every day. Practice letting go, sinking your attention, and emptying your heart, so that you can have the resources of the wise at your command and the light of the hidden one shining through you, so you can know what you're doing and see where you're going. Then you too can be filled with the brightness of the everlasting light and become the unspotted mirror of his power, that is, wisdom. For all who loveth wisdom, loveth life. And they that seek her early shall be filled with joy. Thank you for listening.